The United States Army Air Force is off for Berlin.
Ready for war, sir. Ready for war.
The magnificence of the courage and fortitude of the Korean people defies description.
Other battles were raging in the streets of Saigon.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam.
There has been unusual American air activity in the area of the Persian Gulf.
We are determined to knock out Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb potential.
Afghanistan is a war that we had to fight and we have to win.
This is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join our honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.
To the present day.
In Afghanistan and Iraq, 50 million people are now living in freedom.
Now, the American Veterans Center and Radio America present Veterans Chronicles.
Our guest this week on Veterans Chronicles is Ohio Congressman Bill Johnson, who's also U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, retired Bill Johnson. Sir, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
You joined the Air Force in 1973. What was your motivation for doing so at that time?
You know, I had just graduated from high school, born and raised on a farm. Opportunities didn't seem to be plentiful for me, and plus I was young. I had started to school early. So I graduated in June. I didn't turn 18 until November. So I was barely old enough to join the Air Force anyway. And so many of the jobs that were available to my high school graduating class had already been taken up by the time I turned 18. I saw the Air Force as an option. We had a strong military legacy in my family. And my mother had remarried. My stepfather was Air Force. So I said, look, I'll go give this a shot. Never dreamed in my wildest imagination that I would wind up staying 26 and a half years.
Was it the influence of your stepfather in particular that led you towards the Air Force?
You know, I think when my mother remarried and we left the farm, I found out there was a big world out there. And I became enamored with the airplanes and with the lifestyle and with the camaraderie and the family sense that you felt on the military, on the Air Force installations. Our first place that we lived after my mother remarried was Chanute Air Force Base in Illinois. And I'd never lived in a big city before. I mean, I was born and raised on a two-wheel wagon rut mule farm, no indoor plumbing for much of my childhood. And so that was a big change for me, and so it was very, very attractive.
1973, you have the Paris peace talks, winding down of combat operations in Vietnam, but the military is not super popular, obviously, in certain parts of the population at that point. How much did that influence, or how much did you even think about that at the time?
Well, you know, I grew up in the 60s, and like so many others, I sat and listened every evening as Walter Cronkite gave the play-by-play on the war and what was happening. I lost a first cousin in 1968. He was in the Army and was killed in Vietnam. So I had a strong sense of service to country. And so it was not a surprise to me that I wanted to do this. Now, I will tell you that when I joined, they told many of us that it was likely that we would be going direct duty assignment to Vietnam right out of basic training. But it was in our 17th day of training that the Paris Peace Accords were signed. And so all of a sudden, the whole plan ahead changed. And we all were reclassified, and we had to choose our prospective career areas, and I just got really, really fortunate.
Were you one of those folks that was told not to wear your uniform off base? Was it ever that type of thing?
Because back in those days, you couldn't wear your uniform off base. In fact, you were prohibited from wearing your uniform off base.
Okay.
What today is called the battle dress uniform, or we called them fatigues back then, or your flight suit. You didn't go into business establishments downtown or in the local communities with those uniforms on. You were encouraged to wear civilian clothes. And some of the uniforms were just, they were off limits. You weren't allowed to wear them downtown. But it was, you certainly could feel the vibe in the local communities about the feelings about the Vietnam War.
Where did you do your basic?
I did basic at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas.
And how long did that last?
6 weeks. 6 weeks.
And at that point, did you know what you wanted to specialize in the Air Force? Did they direct you in a certain way by that point?
You know, I didn't. I had signed up under what was called a guaranteed career area, guaranteed field, which was electronics. I had scored high on the electronics part of the ASVAB. And so I knew that I was probably going to be an electronics technician of some sort. Little did I know that my best friend in high school, his father, was the superintendent over the training devices section where we taught student pilots how to fly on simulators. And to this day, he's deceased now. My friend's father is deceased, so I never got a chance to ask him whether or not he called and put in a good word or did anything like that. But I was extremely pleased when I was selected for the career field to be a flight simulator instructor and maintenance technician on the simulators. That was about as close to flying that I thought I would actually get myself.
And you talked about your fascination with planes growing up, and that was one of the reasons you tilted towards the Air Force. Was the reality and the simulators and the actual work close to what you thought it would be, or was it pretty different?
It was better than I thought it was going to be. You know, I had the opportunity to instruct and to work alongside some great Americans, you know, and it was a senior master sergeant that took a special interest in me. My mother, you know, was until she married my stepfather, and that relationship didn't work either. But for the most part, I was raised by a single mom, and so I didn't have strong father figures in my life. And at that time, he was a senior master sergeant. Russ Jarvis took a very, very special interest in me, and he called me in one day and he said, "Look, I'm going to be putting you up for Airman of the Quarter. I want you to start showing some self motivation. Do some things that I can write about. So it shows that you're interested in bettering yourself." So he sent me to the education office, and we filled out a lot of paperwork, and I started taking a few night classes. And the following year, to my utter amazement, I was selected for an ROTC scholarship. I did not know that the technical school that I had been to, that lasted some 9 months, had given me almost 2 years of Community College of the Air Force credit. That combined with the night schools that I took, I had nearly 2 years of formal college education, and so I qualified for an ROTC scholarship, and everything changed at that point.
What did you study in those 9 months? Anything in particular?
Well, I was doing just general studies, you know, the maths, the English, the histories, the general studies type things. But the funny thing was when the Air Force selected me for the scholarship, they asked me what I wanted to major in and what job I wanted. And I almost couldn't believe that this was happening to me. So I said, "Well, I'll major in sociology or history," because I didn't feel very confident in mathematics and those kinds of things and the sciences, and I'll be a missile launch officer. You know, nobody wanted to be a missile launch officer. That was the last thing that newly commissioned lieutenants wanted to do. And so they, when they gave me the answer to my questions, they said, "Well, no, you're not going to major in sociology. You're going to major in computer science, and you're going to pilot training." And I said, "You've got to be kidding me," because I had scored like 95% on the pilot part of the AFOQT. So it was 85 or 95, I forget the exact number, but it was a pretty high score, and I couldn't believe what was about to happen.
So you said the ROTC opportunity really changed your life in a number of ways. You've talked a little bit about the changes. What else did that mean?
Well, you know, I had never been to I did do one semester of college at Mississippi State University after graduating from high school. My stepfather had gotten stationed in Columbus, Mississippi, so I went one semester there, but I never lived on campus, never really experienced the college life. When I was accepted for the scholarship, they sent me to Troy University in Alabama. It was called Troy State at the time, and we lived right there on campus. I was married with two children at the time, and the camaraderie, I became the commander of or the cadet commander of the ROTC detachment. Had a great 18 months there, and couldn't have asked for a better experience to get started off on my on a commission career.
And so you mentioned that you were sent to flight school, so that's a dream come true.
It was. I didn't graduate from flight school. I had an inner ear problem that grounded me, and one of the biggest disappointments that I've ever had in my professional career, when I was a senior at Troy, which is about 45 miles south of Montgomery, Alabama, it's about 30 miles north of Enterprise, Alabama. Enterprise, Alabama is where the Army and the Air Force do their helicopter pilot training. So they had offered my graduating class of pilot candidates the opportunity to go to helicopter pilot training right away, get commissioned 1 week, and within a couple of weeks, you're on active duty and starting your pilot training. I wish I had taken that, because the inner ear problem that ultimately grounded me would never have manifested itself in helicopter flying. It's just a different kind of physiological effects on your body. I love to fly, and I wish I had taken them up on that offer.
Where did you go once flight school didn't work out?
Because I had a degree in computer science, they kept me. And computer science turned out to be something that I adapted to very, very quickly and very well. So I became a software engineer.
Congressman, Colonel, we'll be right back on Veterans Chronicles.
Veterans Chronicles is now podcasting at radioamerica.org. Log on to our website, click on the podcasting icon, and look for Veterans Chronicles. Once there, follow the instructions on your computer to subscribe to our podcast. You'll always find our most recent program on the Veterans Chronicles podcast, in addition to past programs from our archives. The Veterans Chronicles podcast, free and online at radioamerica.org. Also available on Apple iTunes.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Our guest this week on Veterans Chronicles is Congressman Bill Johnson. For 26 years, he served in the United States Air Force, retiring as a lieutenant colonel. So at this point, were we the late 70s, very early 80s, and what type of opportunities were available in computer science?
Well, they were looking for, the Air Force was looking for a lot of software engineers. Computer programming was a really big thing. So I started out as a Fortran programmer, COBOL programmer at Randolph Air Force Base in Texas. Was there for 2 years when another education opportunity cropped up that I was totally unaware was going to come my way. I was selected for what was then called the Senior Commander-Sponsored Education Program. Each four-star in the Air Force could select two officers from their command to go to a civilian school to get an advanced degree. And I didn't even know I was being considered. I found out about it quite happenstance. But I got selected and went to Georgia Tech to get a graduate degree in computer science, and then became a program manager and started developing large-scale networks and implementing large-scale projects. It was a fantastic career that certainly translated later after I retired into the businesses that I started.
How different was it building a network then compared to now?
Much, much different. When I came along in the Air Force, we did a lot of things organically. We had a lot of computer programmers. A lot of the software that ran the Air Force's back office systems, whether it was supply or logistics or medical or finance, and that was my specialty. They had me working in the finance arena. That was all organically grown with military uniformed personnel writing the code. So it was, we were on the ground floor of some of the really innovative capabilities in computer science in those days.
Was it pretty uniform that folks saw this emerging technology as vital to the military, or was there kind of a debate at that time about whether this was the right way to be going, the right way to be investing?
Well, from what I recall, in many ways, the military was leading the effort in computing technologies in those days. You know, we were still in 79 and 80, in that time frame, we were very much in the Cold War. So we were still putting up large systems that were looking over the border for intercontinental ballistic missiles, space systems to make sure that we could see what would be coming our way, developing systems that would counter an intercontinental ballistic threat. So there was a lot of emphasis on remaining state of the art in computing and communicating technologies. So it was quite exciting.
That suggests that you might have had something to do with SDI. I don't know if you did or not, but when you talk about the defending against a missile threat, emerging technologies of the 1980s, that certainly comes to mind. Was that something you dealt with?
I did not deal with it specifically. I was never I never developed software for the space sector. I spent most of my development time in back office systems, again, finance. Implementing local area networks and those kinds of things. Back when local area networks weren't even considered fashionable for the most part.
Wow. A couple minutes left before our next break. As the 80s went on and into the 90s, how much of a learning curve was there for you, and how much did it change what the Air Force was trying to do with these networks?
Well, I moved very quickly into management after I finished graduate school in 84. I became a section chief and then later went to Air Command and Staff College, was a program manager on some large systems implementations. It wasn't until I got to Eglin Air Force Base in 93, that the learning curve really took off, because I had been a software engineer, never worked tactically at the base level, and all of a sudden I was a squadron commander over the Air Force's largest communications squadron at the time, the equivalent of a small city with five active air wings, three airports, and all the runways and the navigation systems to maintain, and a tactical unit that I was responsible for that deployed in support of a fighter wing. So there was a big learning curve there.
Just about 30 seconds before we have to hit our last break here. In terms of where you were then and where we are now, are you amazed at the technological advances, or is it something that you kind of figured even back then, look how far we've come from the 70s to the 90s, it's obviously going to end up going exponentially further?
You know, I'm constantly amazed at what we Americans are able to do. I actually conceived the idea of an iPad-type device back in the mid-80s. But the technology was not there to deliver it. I hold a patent on a device that looks remarkably like what the iPad eventually became to be. Jokingly tell folks that I get the bragging rights, but Apple gets the money.
Very good, sir. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with Congressman and Lieutenant Colonel Bill Johnson right after this.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
Radio America and the American Veterans Center. This is Veterans Chronicles.
This is Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus, honored to be joined today by Ohio Congressman Bill Johnson. For 26 years, he served in the United States Air Force, retiring with the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. Probably the most significant military action during your active duty time was the Gulf War, and obviously much of that was an air campaign. How did your work influence how successful we were able to be in that campaign?
Certainly two things. Well, there were actually two operations. During the Gulf War, I was stationed at the Air Force's what was called the Standard Systems Center, where all of the Air Force's big systems were developed, whether it was finance, logistics, security, medical, all of those. And I was the executive officer to the commander there. And so we were involved in all of the like the combat ammunition system, the system that ran the flight line and manages the maintenance on engines, airframes. We touched software that dealt with every aspect of the Air Force's operational mission. And so from that, in that regard, I was very involved in the background, touching so many things that ultimately benefited the warfighter overseas. In the mid-90s, at Eglin Air Force Base, I was as the commander of the communications squadron there. We had what was called the Wing Initial Communications Package, and we had a contingent of about 14 airmen who would deploy as part of the advanced package any time that a fighter wing deployed. And when we went into Haiti back in the mid-90s, ultimately we never actually conducted the operation because the dictator there decided to leave and to surrender. So that was a good thing. But my unit provided the support. And during the Khobar Towers bombing, in 96, I had two of my airmen in my unit that I had deployed with the 33rd Fighter Wing. That's where 19 Americans were killed. All of them were from my base, and one of my troops received a Purple Heart for his injuries. He actually lived in the dormitory that was blown up and barely made it out with his life.
Terrorism obviously is a huge issue now. It was an emerging issue really throughout the 80s to some extent, and as you just talked about, into the 90s with Khobar Tower being a major event. How did that change protocols? Did it lead to new systems or other projects you worked on as that threat became more evident and more sinister?
You know, we didn't mainstream Air Force up until 1997. We didn't talk about and deal with the terrorist threat like we do today. Certainly the Air Force today, with its unmanned aerial vehicles and all of the capabilities that are there, very, very tactical, laser-focused precision strike capability. Even though we had some of that capability back then, you didn't hear the terms Al-Qaeda or Hezbollah or Hamas or ISIL. You didn't think about it in those terms. Now, when I left Eglin in 97 and went to U.S. Special Operations Command, that's where I began to learn that there was another evil element out there that we had to be prepared for. There was a lot of talk, but it wasn't just specifically Air Force. It was all of the services combined. You had the Navy SEALs, you had Army Special Forces, Air Force Special Operations, and of course Marines that were involved in all of that. So I saw it grow and the emphasis on it grow, but really it began to take off, I think, around the 2000 time frame when I retired.
Sure. Talk a little bit more about your time, those last couple of years of your active duty mm-hmm. at Special Forces Command. That's obviously quite a bit different than what you had been doing before then. What was that like? What were you focused on mainly there?
It was a very rare opportunity. It was in the vernacular of the Air Force, it was called a joint assignment, and it was a rare exception to be selected for that kind of position. You had to go through an interview process, and I felt very, very fortunate to have been selected. I ultimately wound up as the director of the CIO staff, the Chief Information Officer staff, working for an Army colonel, and the head of our department, the actual CIO, was a Navy admiral who had been the first commander of the Navy SEALs training school. And had been a Navy SEAL himself, or was a Navy SEAL himself. And my job was working all of the communicating and computing programs for special operations, whether it was Army, Air Force, Navy, air to air, air to ground, ground to ground. And I had two senior officers from each service and two senior civilians that worked on my staff. And we ran all of those programs. And so we were involved, for example, in Y2K and making sure that all of the embedded systems were capable of handling the turnover of the clock from 99 to 2000. So it was a phenomenal 2 years. Fast-paced, I remember it very fondly and met some of our nation's real heroes working there. Several times in my career, I was told to get ready. But then when it came time to get on the airplane to go, they decided that the mission was going a different direction and I didn't have to deploy. So that's actually a regret that I have, that I was never able to deploy into an operational theater. There's something about the military, particularly the Air Force. It really is a family. There's something that happens to an individual when they're broken down as an individual and built back up to be a stronger person and yet capable of operating as a team. There's a lot of comfort and there's a lot of motivation to do your best because you know other people are depending upon you. So it was an experience that I will never, ever forget.
Camaraderie that can't be found, really.
You can't find it anywhere else.
Congressman, we've just got a few minutes left in our conversation here.
Sure.
We talked about the terrorist threat that was emerging in the 1990s. Obviously, since then, we had the Cole, 9/11, obviously, and it's been the focal point of our foreign policy ever since. Right now, of course, one of the major threats is the Islamic State, and there's a lot of debate right now about what the proper policy is. I don't want to get too political, but from the leadership that you gain from over a quarter century in the military, what type of general approach is needed when a threat like this presents itself?
Well, you know, I'm not the president, but I would tell you what I believe, based on my experience, should be done. First of all, the president should be listening very, very closely to our senior military commanders to assess the threat and to get advice on what we need to destroy that threat. And I do believe that ISIL needs to be destroyed, not downgraded, ultimately destroyed. The president should be building an international coalition of our friends and allies that believe strongly in the Western values that we have, because anyone who doesn't understand that this evil is threatening American values and our way of life, then we're burying our collective heads in the sand. And thirdly, the president should come to Congress and say, look, this is what our military leadership says we need to destroy this threat, and this is what we should provide, and I want to work with Congress to do that. That's what we need to be doing. This is not something that we can sit and wait on. This terrorist threat is engulfing the entire world, and we've got to face it for what it is. It's a war with radical Islam, and it, we have to call it what it is. You know, Reagan brought down the Soviet Empire, and he brought down the wall by calling the Soviet Empire what it was, the evil empire. You can't fight an enemy that you don't that you can't identify. And so I think it's very, very important that we show leadership, that we show that we're strong enough to handle this, because the other countries and the peoples of other countries that share our values are watching very closely to see whether or not America is going to continue to stand watch.
We're in mid-February 2015 as we have this discussion. Do you get the sense right now we're winning this fight against ISIL?
Well, winning is relative. And I think that we're at a tipping point. We've seen since 2001 to where we are today, we have not moved that threat very far in terms of eliminating it. Al-Qaeda, you destroy it in one place, it just goes somewhere else and crops up somewhere else. We have to have a full-on policy and strategic plan to go after this. You've got to go after them militarily, destroy them where they are, where they're sleeping, where they're working, where they're hiding. But you also have to go after their support structure. Where are they getting the funding from? One of the things, and this may sound a little bit odd, but that's why it is so vitally important that America attain energy independence. You know, where is this terrorist threat cropping up from? It's cropping up from a region of the world that we have poured billions and billions and billions of dollars into over the years, buying our energy resources from those countries. We need to stop that. We've got the capability to be energy independent here at home and help our friends and allies across the globe. And if we cut off the funding source, that would go a long way.
A couple minutes left, sir. One of the other things that's been talked about a lot lately, whether it's the hacking of Sony or I think it was the Twitter account of Central Command, cybersecurity. Obviously, you've got some experience in that area. How well are we doing? What else could we be doing?
It is a never-ending battle. And anyone who doesn't understand that it's going to require increased and constant vigilance in order to stay ahead of the problem, it's the nature of computing and communicating technologies. Computers can do only two things. They can add strings of ones and zeros together, and they can shift strings of ones and zeros one direction or another, to the left or to the right. It's an on-off switch. And as long as computers function off of ones and zeros at the core, you're going to have bad guys that are going to find a way to get into them. Because programming, developing computer code with ones and zeros is not that tough. I've done it. So it is a problem that we have to stay out in front of, because communicating and computing technology basically controls the world today. You're talking to me right now while you're managing this on an iPhone. All of our financial systems, our healthcare systems, our power and energy systems, not to mention much of our, almost all of our military infrastructure, radar, the capability to laser direct a weapon system, that's all communicating technology, backed and undergirded by a strong platform of computing technology. And we're going to have to stay on top of it, because if the bad guys get in, it's going to be very, very difficult.
Last topic before we let you go, sir. Thank you very much for your time again.
Thank you.
Funding for the military. You joined the military in the 70s. Funding went down after the Vietnam War. Obviously, in the Reagan years, it beefed back up. In the 90s, it went down. 2000s, back up for the war on terror. Now it's been gone down again through sequester and various other means.
Right.
Obviously, we've got debt problems, we've got deficit problems, but a strong military is obviously a huge priority. So what does the current level of spending mean for our military, and what's your opinion on what's the right place to do it?
The current level of spending is not adequate. That being said, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, said that the greatest threat to our national security is our debt. There are a lot of things that the federal government does that it shouldn't be doing. There's one thing that it must do, and that's provide for our national security. We've got to find a way to balance what is needed to secure our homeland, to protect our interests abroad, and to meet our commitments to our friends and our allies and in the world community. And that means we're going to have to make those tough decisions around the collective dinner table of America about what we're not going to do. Because there's not an endless pot of money. We cannot ask the American people to continue giving and giving and giving when wages continue to shrink. And there's a definite balance. But maintaining our national security, that's number one. That's the only thing in our sworn oath that we swear to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. That's the only legal requirement of the office that I hold. And that is so vitally important. And I don't ever take national security for granted. We've got to do a better job with making sure that we've got the funding and the resources for our men and women in uniform to do their jobs.
Ohio Congressman Bill Johnson retired in 1999 after 26 years in the United States Air Force, rising to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. This is Veterans Chronicles.
This has been Veterans Chronicles, produced by Radio America and the American Veterans Center. Veterans Chronicles is available wherever you are. Log on to www.radioamerica.org and click on the podcasting icon. Look for Veterans Chronicles and follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast.